I have decided on balance to move the election by 4 weeks to the 17th of October.
The COVID-19 pandemic pushes back one country's elections. This is Tuesday, the 18th of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead today, the U.S. Democratic Convention gets underway with some major changes. South Korea takes some major steps back in its fight against the pandemic. We'll take a closer look at challenges to the Afghanistan peace plan. And gun sales in the United States see a major increase. It is all on today's VOA Asia. New Zealand's general election due next month has been postponed for 4 weeks because of a spike in coronavirus cases. The Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, says the new date on 17 October gives parties the opportunity to plan their campaigns around any COVID-19 restrictions. In Australia, the state of emergency has been extended as the state of Victoria records another grim milestone. More than 400 people have died from the virus in Australia, 22 in New Zealand. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had been under increasing pressure to delay an election due in September. Most campaigning has been halted by a spike in coronavirus cases in Auckland, which is under a two-week lockdown. Ardern says polling day will now be on October 17.
Moving an election date, especially this late in the electoral cycle, is a significant decision. Our resurgence plan is in full swing. There are high levels of testing, rapid contact tracing, alongside the level 3 restrictions that are all designed to limit the spread of the current cluster. However, it is clear that the re-emergence of COVID in Auckland at the beginning of the formal campaign period has been cause for concern.
The source of the infections is still a mystery. New Zealand's main opposition National Party had argued the election should be delayed until November or even into next year. They believe restrictions on campaigning because of the pandemic would give the Prime Minister an unfair advantage. Jacinda Ardern had been widely praised for crushing the virus and is expected to win another term. But her opponents hope she will lose some of her lustre once hardships caused by the Auckland lockdown begin to bite. Across the Tasman Sea, Australia has recorded its deadliest day of the pandemic so far. 25 people have died in the state of Victoria in the past day. 282 new coronavirus cases have been reported, prompting some optimism by disease experts. Professor Jodie McVernon, the Director of Epidemiology at the Doherty Institute in Melbourne, says daily infection rates in Victoria are going down.
We've obviously been in a situation just a few weeks ago where we were seeing numbers in the 700s. Those numbers are now coming down into the 200s or maybe around 300. And with that, we're seeing fewer numbers of contacts of cases being reported. We're seeing less clusters and outbreaks being reported. And overall, the number of healthcare worker infections are coming down. And all of those are really positive indicators.
Victoria has also extended a state of emergency for another month. The city of Melbourne remains in lockdown and other restrictions apply across the entire state. Organisers of Sydney's New Year's Eve fireworks are under increasing pressure to cancel the famous display because of the pandemic. The City Council is conceding that it may not be responsible to encourage large crowds to the glittering spectacle. The City of Melbourne could also lose the rights to host the Australian Rules Football Grand Final, the nation's biggest sporting event, in October, because of the COVID-19 crisis. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. The Japanese Prime Minister visits a hospital amid speculation about his health. The Trump administration announces it will further tighten restrictions on Huawei technologies. Thousands of protesters call for radical changes to the Thai government in near daily protests led by students. India reports its coronavirus death toll has surpassed 50,000 after it confirmed more than 900 new dead in one day. Google pushes back against a proposed Australian law over paying for news content. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. We continue on VOA Asia. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden looks to make it official this week when he formally accepts his party's nomination at the Democratic National Convention. Biden made history last week by naming California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, the first black woman and the first person of Indian descent on a presidential ticket this week, also becomes part of a history-making, mostly virtual, Democratic National Convention. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris made their first joint appearance in Wilmington, Delaware last week. This after the historic decision to name her as his running mate in the Democrats' effort to defeat Republican President Donald Trump in the November election. This election cycle, the Democratic National Convention, or DNC, selected Milwaukee, Wisconsin as the host city. But concerns of COVID-19 moved most of the official nominating ceremony online. It will still feature party heavyweights, past and present, from former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton and former President Barack Obama to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the first-term representative from New York. Former presidential candidate and current Senator Bernie Sanders says Harris bolsters the party's ticket.
I believe that Kamala is, as somebody who has known her for a number of years, incredibly smart, incredibly tough. And I would not like to be Vice President Pence in a debate with her. I think she's an asset for the Biden campaign, and I think she's going to do great on the campaign trail.
I heard it today that she doesn't meet the requirements. And by the way, the lawyer that wrote that piece is a very highly qualified, very talented lawyer.
President Trump at a recent news conference in Washington said he heard compelling arguments questioning Harris's eligibility to run in response to a question from VOA. Harris was born in Oakland, California, and critics compared Trump's remarks to his previous false allegations questioning former President Obama's U.S. citizenship.
I'm signing this because I'm in this race to win.
Senior Trump campaign advisor Jason Miller blames the news media for focusing on the issue regarding Harris's eligibility.
This is something that the media keeps bringing up, whether to him in his press conferences or even in interview formats like this where it's being brought up. It is not something that anyone in our campaign is talking about. The president said that he doesn't, it's not something they're pursuing, not something that we're interested in. And in our opinion, it is case closed, end of story, and the only folks who keep bringing it up are the media.
The one thing that remains undisputed is the upcoming Democratic National Convention, where Biden is expected to receive and accept the party's nomination for the presidency. Trump will accept his party's nomination at the Republican National Convention that begins on the 24th. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, four Indian security forces and two militants were killed in related incidents in Kashmir Monday in one of the deadliest days in the disputed Muslim-majority region since its autonomy was ended last year. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. South Korea, which had effectively contained one of the world's first coronavirus outbreaks, is seeing a COVID-19 resurgence, with officials warning the country could be on the verge of another large-scale eruption. I talked about it with VOA Seoul correspondent Bill Gallo.
What we're seeing in Seoul is four consecutive days of new infections of coronavirus in the triple digits, which may not sound like a lot compared to many countries, but for South Korea, it's quite significant. You know, the numbers that they had seen on a daily basis before that was something like 20 or 30 new cases a day. It was a very manageable level. And so starting 4 days ago, we started to see this pick up, and it got up to near 300 cases yesterday. This is concerning because most of the infections they're seeing are in the Seoul metropolitan area. It's very densely populated, of course. It's where over half of South Korea's population lives. And it really hasn't been impacted very much by the earlier infections you saw in February and March in South Korea. So authorities are actually concerned that because of the nature of these infections, and it's not just one cluster infection, it's many, many cluster infections, that this may actually be a more dangerous situation than what this country saw back in the early spring.
Was there or is there a situation that a particular church is being blamed for this?
The most dangerous cluster infection that we've seen was at a Presbyterian church in the Seoul metropolitan area. This is a mega church, like very many mega churches there are in the Seoul area, that have continued to meet. This particular church is led by a controversial right-wing pastor who involves himself in politics quite a bit. He has accused the government here of many things, but most recently he's accused the government of intentionally falsifying the test results, the coronavirus test results of his church members. About 300 of them so far have tested positive. And as of tonight, actually, that pastor has tested positive. This is notable because over the weekend, he attended a very large political rally with many of his congregants. Authorities are trying to track down people who attended that unauthorized protest to sort of make sure everyone's tested and you know, they can do the contact tracing there.
Are lockdowns coming again?
Yes, they have actually increased the social distancing measures, which is quite a shame because, you know, we had really figured this out, it felt like, in South Korea. Life had, in a lot of ways, returned to normal. There were even fans at baseball games. Of course, the fans weren't, you know, completely filling the stadiums, but they were increasing it every few weeks. And now there will be no fans at baseball stadiums. They have banned indoor gatherings of more than 50 people and outdoor gatherings of more than 100 people. They also say that more restrictions could be on the way if these numbers don't stabilize.
The pandemic has had an effect on the planned military exercises as well.
That's right. So in a couple of ways, they've affected the exercises. The main way is that the U.S. and South Korean troops, which are starting these exercises on Tuesday, will only be doing online training. They will not be doing sort of these field exercises. That doesn't happen every year at this particular exercise, but I think there was a sense that they wanted to do that, in part because of the earlier exercises in the spring that were canceled because of coronavirus. These exercises have already been scaled back for a while because of Donald Trump actually scaling them back in order to make room for diplomacy with North Korea. So it's a situation where I think you have a lot of experts who are concerned that perhaps U.S. and South Korean soldiers who rotate in and out of their mission here in Korea will not have had sort of that hands-on field training that they have had for years as a result of these scaled-back exercises.
Now, North Korea has reacted to these military exercises in the past. Do you think a scaled-down military exercise will alleviate that?
I think we can only sort of just wait and see on that. North Korea seems to get upset about things whenever it wants to get upset about things, it seems like to me. But it is definitely notable, as you say, they have very often gotten upset at these exercises in the past, even when they've been scaled back. So it would not be surprising to see in the next week some sort of response from North Korea.
Bill Gallo is our Seoul correspondent for VOA. Bill, once again, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Japan was hit by its biggest economic slump on record in the second quarter as the coronavirus pandemic emptied shopping malls and crushed demand for cars and other exports. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. Ahead of an upcoming release of Taliban detainees held in Afghan prisons, the insurgent group warned the government in Kabul against any attack on those released, saying such incidents would jeopardize the peace talks. A Taliban spokesman told the Associated Press there have been at least 11 such attacks in the past several months, instances when freed Taliban figures were killed, harassed, and rearrested by government forces. Kabul officials deny unwarranted attacks on freed Taliban. The prisoner release is part of a deal the insurgents signed with the United States earlier this year. A Taliban prisoner release may have hit a snag as several countries, including France, have expressed opposition to the release of some hardcore Taliban fighters. I spoke with Michael Kugelman, the senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center think tank in Washington, about what has led up to these latest developments.
Back at the end of February, the U.S. government concluded an agreement with the Taliban that essentially led to the formation of a withdrawal schedule for U.S. forces. But one of the other features of that agreement was a Taliban prisoner release agreement, in which essentially the Afghan government would release 5,000 Taliban prisoners in its custody. At the same time, you were going to have, the idea was for the Taliban to release some Afghan prisoners. But the main thing here is we were talking about 5,000 Taliban prisoners in the custody of the Afghan government. Now, what was controversial about this is that was an arrangement that came out of a negotiation that did not involve the Afghan government. It involved only the U.S. government and the Taliban. And so essentially, the Afghan government was put in a position where it had to make a very difficult decision as to whether it could afford, in terms of security, to release so many Taliban prisoners, including several hundred that, according to the Afghan government, had been convicted of murder and all kinds of terrible things. But eventually what happened was that the Afghan government concluded that if it was to have any chance of launching a peace process with the Afghan government, that it would have to essentially agree to this stipulation in a negotiation that did not involve the Afghan government. Basically, that's where things have come today, where after the convening of a Woya Jirga, essentially a large gathering of tribal leaders in Afghanistan, made a decision to release all of these Taliban prisoners, including the last 400 that were particularly dangerous. But now what we're hearing is the fact that there are some countries that are very worried about the security implications of all of this. So it's really a very complicated story, and it comes down to weighing the costs and benefits of, on the one hand, releasing dozens and even hundreds of very dangerous individuals, and on the other hand, doing that in order to have the best chance of launching a peace process to end the war in Afghanistan.
How strong are the recommendations or the plea to not receive these prisoners from France and some other countries?
I would admit that I was surprised to hear these concerns expressed by France and a few others. I think that the Afghan government has said that it needs to hold off on concluding everything until it gets the consensus of the international community, including the likes of France, which has been concerned. But I do think that at the end of the day, most countries, much of the international community recognizes that this is a very risky move by the Afghan government to release these Taliban prisoners, but that it has to happen in order to have any chance of launching a peace process that the international community, including the French, really want to end. So I imagine that this will not become a major issue, will not become a major obstacle to completing this process of releasing these remaining Taliban prisoners. But certainly I think it underscores just how complicated and risky this whole thing is.
Is there a rift on this between the United States and the Afghan government?
I think that there probably had been earlier on. I think that the U.S. government has been pressuring the Afghan government for quite some time to agree to really essentially speed up and complete this process of releasing all the prisoners. And that's because the U.S. government, the Trump administration, really wants a peace process to begin. It wants there to be a lot of progress made in a peace process as the U.S. removes forces, because for the U.S. government, the optics of pulling so many troops from Afghanistan, which is already happening, are not very positive. If that's happening while at the same time the Taliban is continuing to fight the war and is not sitting for peace talks. So the optics are much better for the U.S. of having this prisoner release process end so that the peace process can begin. But for good reason, the Afghan government wanted to take it slow, particularly because it was not involved in the negotiation that led to this very tricky situation of having to release so many Taliban prisoners. But I do think that now that the Afghan government has made it clear that it is going to complete this process of releasing these Taliban prisoners, I think that will ease any tensions that may have arisen between the U.S. and Afghanistan on this issue.
Michael Kugelman is the Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, a think tank in Washington.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
This is VOA Asia. The global health crisis has put the dreams of millions of poor Indians aiming to join the ranks of the middle class into an indefinite freeze. For one man, it means he may not be able to put his younger brother through law school. Francis McGuire has more.
Ashish Kumar shares a common dream with millions of Indian workers to escape poverty and join the country's growing middle class. But like many, the 20-year-old's aspirations have been put on hold by the global health crisis. Ashish was a technician with a degree in plastic molding, a big step for his family who lived most of his life in a mud hut. Until March, Ashish worked 8-hour shifts making boxes for Ferrero Rocher chocolates, earning $173 every month, and he was able to send some of this income home to support his family, including enough to build a proper brick home and put his younger brother into law school. The money stopped coming in, though, when India went into lockdown and Ashish's factory shut down. Now out of work, he's been forced to make the 900-mile return trip home to North India.
The dream that I wanted to realize by the year 2022 or 23 has now been pushed back by 2 to 4 or 5 years. As of now, I cannot do anything for the next 4 to 5 years.
It's estimated at least 10 million people in India returned to the villages they'd left behind when lockdown began. Overall, the International Monetary Fund estimates the country's economy will contract 4.5% this year. Ashish originally planned to save up and build his own recycling factory. Now he and millions like him face an uncertain future to see whether their dreams of economic freedom can ever be realized.
That was Reuters' Francis McGuire reporting. According to a report by the Brookings Institution, almost 3 million more firearms have been sold since March, much more than the same period in previous years. It also says there is evidence that people who have never owned guns before are lining up to get one. Elena Wolf has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Shooting range instructor Sam Barbakov helps unload guns after a busy day at a shooting gallery. Barbakov, who moved to the U.S. from Russia, has always loved firearms. And he's in the right place. Florida is a gun-friendly state. Floridians own 450,000 registered firearms. That's the second highest level of gun ownership in the country, behind Texas. Recently, though, even this gun-loving state has seen a major spike in sales and new gun owners since March. And it's happening all over the U.S. Americans are purchasing guns at record high numbers throughout the country. The National Instant Criminal Background Check System, run by the FBI, performed over 19 million background checks in the first half of the year. That's 6 million more than in the first half of 2019. According to the Brookings Institution, concerns about personal safety are driving the rise in demand for guns. In March, it says buyers expressed concern about COVID and the economic downturn. More recently, authors of the report say those same fears, plus widespread protests against racial injustice sparked by the death of George Floyd, drove sales. For Ileana Wolf in Delray Beach, Florida, NRI's VOA News.
Our thanks to you for joining us. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please take care of yourself, stay safe, and enjoy the day ahead.